Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Welcome back, everyone, to 1001 Classic Short Stories and Tales. This is your host, John Hagedorn. Today, two great stories by two exceptional authors. The first, Indian Camp, by Ernest Hemingway, and the second, The 9 Cent Girls, by Henry Cuyler Bunner. Indian Camp was first published in a 1924 issue of the Parisian literary magazine Transatlantic Review. The next year, Indian Camp was included in Hemingway's first story collection, In Our Time, and it's since become one of his most heavily anthologized works. Based partly on his visits to Petoskey, Michigan during childhood and young adulthood, Indian Camp follows young Nick Adams as he accompanies his physician father on a medical errand. The story is not for the faint of heart. It includes the delivery of an Indian baby, and it includes suicide. Indian Camp also features characteristics that now define Hemingway as an author, including his iceberg theory of writing and themes like humanity's relationship to nature and performances of masculinity. Now, Indian Camp, by Ernest Hemingway. At the lake shore, there was another rowboat drawn up. The two Indians stood waiting. Nick and his father got in the stern of the boat, and the Indians shoved it off, and one of them got into row. Uncle George sat in the stern of the Camp rowboat. The young Indian shoved the Camp boat off and got in to row Uncle George. The two boats started off in the dark. Nick heard the oarlocks of the other boat quite a way ahead of them in the mist. The Indians rowed with quick, choppy strokes. Nick lay back with his father's arm around him. It was cold on the water. The Indian who was rowing them was working very hard, but the other boat moved further ahead in the mist all the time. "Where are we going, Dad?" Nick asked. "Over to the Indian camp. There is an Indian lady very sick." "Oh," said Nick. Across the bay, they found the other boat beached. Uncle George was smoking a cigar in the dark. The young Indian pulled the boat way up on the beach. Uncle George gave both the Indians cigars. They walked up from the beach through a meadow that was soaking wet with dew, following the young Indian who carried a lantern. Then they went into the woods and followed a trail that led to the logging road that ran back into the hills. It was much lighter on the logging road as the timber was cut away on both sides. The young Indian stopped and blew out his lantern, and they all walked on along the road. They came around a bend, and a dog came out barking. Ahead were the lights of the shanties where the Indian bark peelers lived. More dogs rushed out at them. The two Indians sent them back to the shanties. In the shanty nearest the road, there was a light in the window. An old woman stood in the doorway, holding a lamp. Inside, on a wooden bunk, lay a young Indian woman. She'd been trying to have her baby for 2 days. All the old women in the camp had been helping her. The men had moved off up the road to sit in the dark and smoke out of the range of the noise she made. She screamed just as Nick and the two Indians followed his father and Uncle George into the shanty. She lay in the lower bunk, very big under a quilt. Her head was turned to one side. In the upper bunk was her husband. He had cut his foot very badly with an axe 3 days before. He was smoking a pipe. The room smelled very bad. Nick's father ordered some water to be put on the stove, and while it was heating, he spoke to Nick. "This lady is going to have a baby, Nick," he said. "I know," said Nick. "You don't know," said his father. "Listen to me. What she is going through is called being in labor. The baby wants to be born, and she wants it to be born. All her muscles are trying to get the baby born. That's what's happening when she screams." "I see," Nick said. Just then the woman cried out. "Oh, Dad, can't you give her something to make her stop screaming?" asked Nick. "No, I haven't any anesthetic," his father said. "But her screams are not important. I don't hear them because they are not important." The husband in the upper bunk rolled over against the wall. The woman in the kitchen motioned to the doctor that the water was hot. Nick's father went into the kitchen and poured about half of the water out of the big kettle into a basin. Into the water left in the kettle, he put several things he unwrapped from a handkerchief. "Those must boil," he said, and began to scrub his hands in the basin of hot water with a cake of soap he had brought from the camp. Nick watched his father's hands scrubbing each other with the soap. While his father washed his hands very carefully and thoroughly, he talked. "You see, Nick, babies are supposed to be born head first, but sometimes they're not. When they're not, they make a lot of trouble for everybody. Maybe I'll have to operate on this lady. We'll know in a little while." When he was satisfied with his hands, he went in and went to work. "Pull back that quilt, will you, George?" he said. "I'd rather not touch it." Later, when he started to operate, Uncle George and three Indian men held the women still. She bit Uncle George on the arm, and Uncle George said, "Damn squaw bitch!" And the young Indian who had rowed Uncle George over laughed at him. Nick held the basin for his father. It all took a long time. His father picked the baby up and slapped it to make it breathe, and handed it to the old woman. "See, it's a boy, Nick," he said. "How do you like being an intern?" Nick said, "All right." He was looking away so as not to see what his father was doing. "There, that gets it," said his father, and put something into the basin. Nick didn't look at it. "Now," his father said, "there's some stitches to put in. You can watch this or not, Nick, just as you like. I'm going to sew up the incision I made." Nick did not watch. His curiosity had been gone for a long time. His father finished and stood up. Uncle George and the three Indian men stood up. Nick put the basin out in the kitchen. Uncle George looked at his arm. The young Indian smiled reminiscently. "I'll put some peroxide on that, George," the doctor said. He bent over the Indian woman. She was quiet now, and her eyes were closed. She looked very pale. She did not know what had become of the baby or anything. "I'll be back in the morning," the doctor said, standing up. "The nurse should be here from St. Ignace by noon, and she'll bring everything we need." He was feeling exalted and talkative as football players are in the dressing room after a game. "That's one for the medical journal, George," he said. "Doing a cesarean with a jackknife and sewing it up with 9-foot tapered gut leaders." Uncle George was standing against the wall, looking at his arm. "Oh, you're a great man, all right," he said. "Ought to have a look at the proud father. They're usually the worst sufferers in these little affairs," the doctor said. "I must say he took it all pretty quietly." He pulled back the blanket from the Indian's head. His hand came away wet. He mounted on the edge of the lower bunk with a lamp in one hand and looked in. The Indian lay with his face toward the wall. His throat had been cut from ear to ear. The blood had flowed down into a pool where his body sagged the bunk. His head rested on his left arm. The open razor lay, edge up, in the blankets. "Take Nick out of the shanty, George," the doctor said. There was no need of that. Nick, standing in the door of the kitchen, had a good view of the upper bunk when his father, the lamp in one hand, tipped the Indian's head back. It was just beginning to be daylight when they walked along the logging road back toward the lake. "I'm terribly sorry I brought you along, Nick," said his father, all his post-operative exhilaration gone. It was an awful mess to put you through. Do ladies always have such a hard time having babies? Nick asked. No, that was very, very exceptional. Why did he kill himself, Daddy? I don't know, Nick. He couldn't stand things, I guess. Do many men kill themselves, Daddy? Not very many, Nick. Do many women? Hardly ever. Don't they ever? Oh, yes, they do sometimes. Daddy? Yes? Where did Uncle George go? He'll turn up all right. Is dying hard, Daddy? No, I think it's pretty easy, Nick. It all depends. They were seated in the boat, Nick in the stern, his father rowing. The sun was coming up over the hills. A bass jumped, making a circle in the water. Nick trailed his hand in the water. It felt warm in the sharp chill of the morning. In the early morning on the lake, sitting in the stern of the boat with his father rowing, he felt quite sure that he would never die. We'll return with our second story right after the sponsor messages.
With Kizik hands-free shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy-on, easy-off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
This episode is brought to you by PwC. When unprecedented times are all the time, it's time to start walking the talk. Leaders like you turn to PwC to see and stay ahead. Upskill your workforce, use intelligent automation, and transform big ideas into breakthrough reinvention. Explore the human-led, tech-powered solutions that help you reinvent. It's all part of the new equation. Learn more at pwc.com.
Our second story today is called The 9 Cent Girls by Henry Kyler Bunner. Cent being spelled C-E-N-T. But actually, the meaning here is that these girls were kind of arranged, sort of like a 7 brides for 7 brothers deal. Now, Henry Kyler Bunner, the author here, had a good sense of humor. He was assistant editor and then full editor of the comic weekly magazine, Puck, and it was in that magazine, in 1890, that he published his short story, The 9 Cent Girls. The story goes this way. Jack Winfield and Richard Cutter are both Westerners, and both men have been jilted. Winfield vows to get a wife soon, despite being stuck in the girlless wilderness of a ranch in Montana. His friend tells him about the town of Tusculum, New York, which is nearly overrun with women, as all the men move to New York City to make their mark. The 9 Cent girls are sisters who each look like the face of the Indian lady on the little red cent, the neatest and most artistic coin that the United States government has ever struck, said one of the men. Despite being resigned never to marry, Cutter is deputed to visit the girls on behalf of the ranchers. But when he calls at their home in Tusculum, he learns that the patriarch had died and no male relative has assumed a similar head of household role for them. That leads Cutter to believe that the whole scheme is busted. He's not going to be able to bring them out. But somehow he convinces the eldest of the women, Euphrosyne, to bring the whole group to the ranch in Montana. And that's when things begin to happen. Hope you enjoy The 9 Cent Girls by Henry Kyler Bunner. Miss Bessie Vox of Baltimore paid a visit to her aunt, the wife of the commandant at Old Fort Starbuck, Montana. She had at her small feet at the garrison and some 2 dozen young ranch owners, the flower of the younger sons of the best society of New York, Boston, and Philadelphia. 37 notches in the long handle of her parasol told the story of her 3 month stay. The 37th was final. She accepted a measly second lieutenant and left all the bachelors for 30 miles around the fort to mourn her and to curse the United States Army. This is the pro-am. Mr. John Winfield, proprietor of the Woofield Hiana, sat astraddle a chair in front of the fire in his big living room and tugged at his handsome black beard as he discussed the situation with his foreman, who was also his confidant, his best friend, and his old college mate. Mr. Richard Cutter stood with his back to the fire, twirled a very blonde mustache, and smoked cigarettes continually while he ministered to his suffering friend, who was sore wounded in his vanity, having been notched number 36 on Miss Vox's parasol. Dick had been notched number 1, but Dick was used to that sort of thing. "By thunder," said Mr. Winfield, "I'm going to get married this year if I have to marry a widow with 6 children. And I guess I'll have to. I've been 10 years in this girlless wilderness, and I never did know any girls to speak of at home. Now you always everlastingly knew girls. What's that place you lived at in New York State, where there were so many girls?"
"Tusculum," replied Mr. Cutter, in a tone of complacent reminiscence. "Nice old town, plastered so thick with mortgages that you can't grow flowers in the front yard. All the fellas strike for New York as soon as they begin to shave. The crop of girls remains, and they wither on the stem. Why, one winter they had a humpback man for their sole society star in the male line. Nice girls, too. Old families. Pretty, lots of them. Good form, too, for provincials."
"Gad," said Jack Winfield, "I'd like to live in Tusculum for a year or so."
"No, you wouldn't. It's powerful dull. But the girls were nice. Now, there were the 9-cent girls."
"The 9-cent girls?"
"No, the 9-cent girls. Catch the difference? They were the daughters of Old Bailey, the civil engineer. 9 of them, ranging from 22, when I was there. That was 10 years ago. Down to, I don't know, a kid in a pinafore. All looked just alike, barring age, and every one had the face of an Indian lady on the Little Red Cent. Do you remember the Indian lady on the Little Red Cent?"
"Hold on," suggested Jack, rising. "I've got one. I've had it ever since I came."
He unlocked his desk, rummaged about in its depths, and produced a specimen of the neatest and most artistic coin that the United States government has ever struck.
"That's it," said Dick, holding the coppery disc in his palm. "It would do for a picture of any one of them. Only the Bailey girls didn't wear feathers in their hair. But there they were, 9 of them. Nice girls, every way. And the whole lot named out of the classics. Old Bailey was strong on the classics. His great-grandfather named Tusculum, and Bailey's own name was M. Cicero Bailey. So he called all his girls by heathen names, and had a row with the parson every christening. Let me see. There was Euphrosyne, and Clelia, and Lydia, and Flora, and Aurora. Those were the twins. I was sweet on one of those twins. And Una, and I can't remember them all, but they were mighty nice girls."
"Probably all married by this time," Jack groaned. "Let me look at that scent." He held it in the light of the fire and gazed thoughtfully upon it.
"Not a one," Dick assured him. "I met a chap from Tusculum last time I was in Butte City, and I asked him. He said there'd only been one wedding in Tusculum in 3 years, and then the local paper had a wire into the church and got out extras."
"What sort of girls were they?" Winfield asked, still regarding the coin.
"Just about like that, for looks. Let me see it again."
Dick examined the scent critically and slipped it into his pocket in an absent-minded way.
"Just about like that. First-rate girls. Old man was as poor as a church mouse, but you never would have known it, the way that house was run. Bright girls, too. At least my twin was. I've forgotten which twin it was, but she was too bright for me."
"And how old did you say they were? How old was the youngest?"
"Oh, I don't know," replied Dick, with a bachelor's vagueness on the question of a child's age. 5, 6, 7, maybe. It's 10 years ago, you know."
"Just coming into grass," observed Mr. Winfield, meditatively.
2 months after the evening on which this conversation took place, Mr. Richard Cutter walked up one of the quietest and most eminently respectable of the streets of Tusculum. Mr. Cutter was nervous. He was, for the second time, making up his mind to attempt a difficult and delicate task. He had made up his mind to it, or had it made up for him, but now he felt himself obliged to go over the whole process in his memory in order to assure himself that the mind was really made up. The suggestion had come from Mr. Winfield.
he remembered with what a dazed incomprehension he had heard his chum's proposition to induce Mr. Bailey and all his family to migrate to Montana and settle at Starbuck. "We'll give the old man all the surveying he wants, and he can have the Ashford's place on the big dam when Ashford goes east in August. Why, the finger of Providence is pointing Bailey straight for Starbuck." With a clearer remembrance of Eastern conventionalities than Mr. Winfield, Dick Cutter had suggested various obstacles in the way of this apparently simple scheme. But Winfield would hear of no opposition, and he joined with him 8 other young ranchmen, who entered into the idea with wild Western enthusiasm and an Arcadian simplicity that could see no chance of failure. These energetic youths subscribed a generous fund to defray the expenses of Mr. Cutter as a missionary to Tusculum, and Mr. Cutter had found himself committed to the venture before he knew it. Now, what had seemed quite feasible in Starbuck's wilds were a different face in prim and proper Tusculum. It dawned on Mr. Cutter that he was about to make a most radical and somewhat impudent proposition to a conservative old gentleman. The atmosphere of Tusculum weighed heavy on his spirits, which were light and careless enough in his adopted home in Montana. Therefore, Mr. Cutter found his voice very uncertain as he introduced himself to the young lady who opened, at his ring, the front door of one of the most respectable houses in that respectable street of Tusculum. "Good morning," he said, wondering which one of the 9-cent girls he saw before him. And then, noting a few threads of gray in her hair, he ventured, "It's Miss Euphrosyne, isn't it? You don't remember me. Mr. Cutter, Dick Cutter, used to live on Ovid Street. Can I see your father?" "My father?" repeated Miss Euphrosyne, looking a little frightened. "Yes, I just want—" "Oh, why, Mr. Cutter, I do remember you now. Didn't you know that Papa died 9 years ago, the year after you left Tusculum?" Dick Cutter leaned against the door jamb and stared speechlessly at Euphrosyne. He noted vaguely that she looked much the same as Avon when he'd last seen her, except that she looked tired and just a shade sad. When he was able to think, he said that he begged her pardon. Then he smiled, faintly. "We couldn't expect you to know," she said simply. "Won't you come in?" "No," stuttered Dick. I'll call later. This evening, if you don't mind. Good day." And he fled to his hotel to pull himself together, leaving Miss Euphrosyne smiling. He sat alone in his room all the afternoon, pondering over the shipwreck of his scheme. What would he tell the boys? What would the boys say? Why had he not thought to write before he came? Why on earth had Bailey taken it into his head to die? After supper, he resolved to call as he had promised. Mrs. Bailey, he knew, had died a year after the appearance of her 9th daughter. But, he thought, with reviving hope, there might be a male head to the family, an uncle, perhaps. The door was opened by Clytie, the youngest of the 9. She ushered him at once into a bright little parlor, hung round with dainty things in artistic needlework and decorative painting. A big lamp glowed on the center table, and around it sat 7 of the sisters, each one engaged in some sort of work, sewing, embroidering, or designing. Nearest the lamp sat Euphrosyne, reading Macaulay aloud. She stopped as he entered, and welcomed him in a half-timid but wholly friendly fashion. Dick sat down, very much embarrassed, in spite of the greeting. It was many years since he had talked to 9 ladies at once, and in truth, a much less embarrassed man might have found himself more or less troubled to carry on a conversation with 9 young women who looked exactly like each other, except for the delicate distinctions of age which a masculine stranger might be well afraid to note. Dick looked from one to the other of the placid classic faces, and could not help having an uneasy idea that each new girl that he addressed was only the last one who had slipped around the table and made herself look a year or two older or younger. But after a while, the pleasant, genial, social atmosphere of the room, sweet with a delicate, winning virginity, thawed out his awkward reserve, and Dick began to talk of the West and Western life, until the 9 pairs of blue eyes, stretched to their widest, fixed upon him as a common focus. It was 11 when he left, with many apologies for his long call. he found the night and the street uncommonly dark, empty, and depressing. "Just the outfit," he observed to himself. "An Old Bailey dead, and the whole scheme busted." For he had learned that the 9 cent girls had not a relative in the world. Under these circumstances, it was clearly his duty to take the morning train for the West. And yet, the next evening, he presented himself, shamefaced and apologetic, at the Bailey's door. He thought that he wanted to make some sort of explanation to Miss Euphrosyne. But what explanation could he make? There was no earthly reason for his appearance in Tusculum. He talked of the West until 11 o'clock, and then he took a hesitating leave. The next day he made a weak pretense of casually passing by when he knew that Miss Euphrosyne was working in the garden, but he found it no easier to explain across the front fence. The explanation never would have been made if it had not been for Miss Euphrosyne. A curious nervousness had come over her, too, and suddenly she spoke out. "Mr. Cutter, excuse me, but what has brought you here? I mean, is it anything that concerns us? Or Papa's affairs? I thought everything was settled. I had hoped." There was nothing for it now but to tell the whole story, and Dick told it. "I suppose you'll think we're a pack of barbarians," he said, when he had come to the end. "And, of course, it's all impracticable now." But Miss Euphrosyne did not seem to be offended, only thoughtful. "Can you call here tomorrow at this time, Mr. Cutter?" she inquired. Miss Euphrosyne blushed faintly when Dick presented himself to hear judgment pronounced. "I suppose you will think it strange," she said, "but if your plan is feasible, I should wish to carry it out. Frankly, I do want to see the girls married. Clelia and Lydia and I are past the time when women think about such things, but Clytie and the rest. And, you know, I can remember how Papa and Mama lived together, and sometimes it seems cruelly hard that those dear girls should lose all that happiness. I'm sure it's the best happiness in the world, and it can never be. Now, if I could get occupation, you know that I'm teaching school, I suppose, and if the rest of the girls could keep up their work for the New York people, why, don't you know, if I didn't tell, if I put it on business grounds, you know, I think they would feel that it was best, after all, to leave Tusculum." Her voice was choked when she recommenced. "It seems awful for me to talk to you in this cold-blooded way about such a thing, but what can we do, Mr. Cutter? You don't know how poor we are. There's nothing for my little Clytie to do but be a dressmaker. And you know what that means in Tusculum. Oh, do you think I could teach school in Starbuckle? Miss Euphrosyne was crying. Dick's census of possible pupils in the neighborhood of Starbuck satisfied Miss Euphrosyne. It troubled Dick's conscience a bit as he walked back to the hotel. "But they'll all be married off before she finds it out, so I guess it's all right," he reflected. The next week, Dick went to New York. This was in pursuance of an idea which he had confided to Winfield on the eve of his fourth setting. "Why," Winfield had said to him, "you are clean left out of this deal, aren't you?" "Of course I am," said Dick. "How am I going to marry a poor girl on $100 a month?" "I might set you up for yourself," began his employer. "Hold on," broke in Dick Cutter with emphasis. "You wouldn't talk that way if you'd ever been hungry yourself. I most starved that last time I tried for myself, and I'd starve next trip, sure. You've been a good friend to me, Jack Winfield. Don't you make a damn fool of yourself and spoil it all." "But," he added, after a pause, "I have a little racket of my own. There's a widow in New York who smiled on yours affectionately once, ere she wed Mammon. I'm going to see if she feels inclined to divide the late lamented's pile with a blonde husband." So, the business at Tusculum being determined, and preparations for the hegira well under way, Dick went to look after his own speculation. He reached New York on Tuesday morning, and called on the lady of his hopes that afternoon. She was out. He wrote to her in the evening, asking when he might see her. On Thursday, her wedding cards came to his hotel by special messenger. He cursed his luck and went cheerfully about attending to a commission which Miss Euphrosyne, after much urging, had given him, trembling at her own audacity. The size of it had somewhat staggered him. She asked him to take an order to a certain large dry-goods house for 9 traveling ulsters, ladies, medium weight, measurements enclosed, for which he was to select the materials. "Men have so much taste," said Miss Euphrosyne. "Papa always knew when we were well-dressed." Dick had to wait while another customer was served. He stared at her in humble admiration. It was a British actress, recently imported. When Mr. Richard Cutter sat on the platform of Tusculum Station and saw his 9 charges approach, ready for the long trip to the far west, it struck him that the pinky dun ulsters with the 6-inch square checks of pale red and blue did not look, on these 9 virgins, as they looked on the British actress. It struck him, moreover, that the 9 fore and aft, or deer-stalker caps which he had thrown in as a friendship's offering, only served to more accentuate a costume already accentuated. But it was too late for retreat. The Baileys had burned their bridges behind them. The old house was sold. Their lot was cast in Montana. He had his misgivings, but he handed them gallantly into the train. It was not a vestibule express, for economy forbade, and they began their journey. He had an uneasy feeling that they were noticed, that the 9 ladies in the ulsters of one pattern, and of the pattern of his choosing, were attracting more attention than any ladies not thus uniformed would have attracted. But he was not seriously disturbed until a loquacious countryman sat down beside him. "Running a lady baseball 9, are you?" he inquired. "I seen one once, down to New York. They can't play ball not to speak of, but it's kind of fun looking at 'em. Couldn't you introduce me to the pitcher?" Mr. Cutter made a dignified reply and withdrew to the smoking car. There a fat and affable stranger tapped him on the back and talked in his ear from the seat behind. "It don't pay, young man," he said. "I've handled 'em. Female minstrels sounds first rate, but they don't give the show that catches the people. You gotter have real talent kinder mixed in with 'em if you want to draw." "Them ladies in your company, where do they show?" inquired the conductor, as he examined the 10 tickets that Dick presented. "What do you mean?" asked the irritated pioneer. "If they show in Cleveland, I'd like to go first rate," the conductor explained. "Those ladies," Dick thundered, at the end of his patience, "are not actresses." "Huh! What'll they be, them?" asked the conductor. They had arrived at Buffalo. They had gone to the Niagara Hotel and had been told that there were no rooms for them, and to the Tipped House, where there were no rooms, and to the Genesee, where every room was occupied. Finally, they'd found quarters in a very queer hotel, where the clerk, as he dealt out the keys, said, "One for Lily, one for Daisy, one for Pansy. Here, boss, sort out the flower bed yourself," as he handed over the bunch. Dick was taking a drink in the dingy barroom and trying to forget the queer looks that had been cast at his innocent caravan all the day when the solitary hall boy brought a message summoning him to Miss Euphrosyne's room. He went with his moral tail between his mental legs. "Mr. Cutter," said Miss Euphrosyne firmly, "we have made a mistake." "It looks that way," replied Dick feebly, "but maybe it's only the ulsters." "No," said Miss Euphrosyne. "The ulsters are part of it, but the whole thing is wrong, Mr. Cutter, and I see it all now. I didn't realize what it meant, but my eyes have been opened. 9 young unmarried women cannot go west with a young man. If you had heard what people were saying all around us in the cars, you don't know. We've got to give up the idea." "Oh, but it was awful." Miss Euphrosyne, trembling, hid her face in her hands. Her tears trickled out through her thin fingers. "And the old house is sold. What shall we do? Where shall we go?" she cried, forgetting Dick utterly, lost and helpless. Dick was stalking up and down the room. "It would be all right," he demanded, "if there was a married woman to lead the gang, and if if we caught on to something new in the Ulster line.
It might be different, Miss Euphrosyne admitted, with a sob. Speaking came hard to her. She was tired and well-nigh worn out.
Then, said Dick, with tremendous emphasis, what's the matter with my marrying one of you?
Why, Mr. Cutter, Miss Euphrosyne cried, I had no idea that you ever thought of. Is it Clytie?
No, said Mr. Cutter. It isn't Clytie.
Is it?
Miss Euphrosyne's eyes lit up with hope long since extinguished.
Is it Aurora?
No. Dick Cutter could have been heard three rooms off. No, he said with all his lungs. It ain't Clytie. It ain't Aurora. Nor it ain't Flora. Nor Melpomene. Nor Sybil. Nor Aviole or Oriole. Nor none of 'em. It's you. I want to marry you. And what's more, I'm going to.
Oh,
said poor Miss Euphrosyne, and hid her face in her hands. She had never thought to be happy, and now she was happy for one moment. That seemed quite enough for her modest soul, and yet more was to come. For once in his life, Dick Cutter seized the right moment to do the right thing. 1 hour later, Miss Euphrosyne Bailey was Mrs. Richard Cutter. She did not know quite how it happened. Clytie told her she had been bullied into it. But oh, such sweet bullying! No, said Mr. Richard Cutter one morning in September of the next year to Mr. Jack Winfield and his wife, Miss Aurora Bailey, that was. I can't stop a minute. We're too busy up at the ranch. The wife has just bought out Wilkinson, and I've got to round up all his stock. I'll see you next month at Clytie's wedding. Queer, she should have gone off the last, ain't it? Euphrosyne and I are going down to Butte City Monday to buy her a present. You know anybody who wants to pay 6% for 1,000? Hope you enjoyed The 9 Cent Girls by Henry Kyler Bunner here at 1001 Classic Short Stories and Tales. If you enjoy our stories, please do take a moment and send us a kind review for 1001 Classic Short Stories and Tales. This is your host and storyteller, John Hagedorn, always trying to bring you new and interesting short stories to listen to. And I enjoyed these two very much. Hope you did as well. Everyone stay safe out there, and we'll be back soon.